This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is journalist Marianne Pearl, the widow of Daniel Pearl, who was kidnapped and beheaded by Islamic extremists in Pakistan last year. Daniel Pearl was the South Asia bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal. When Marianne last saw him, he was on his way to a meeting with the radical Islamic cleric Sheikh Mubarak Ali Shah Jalani in the hopes of investigating his connection to Richard Reid, the alleged shoe bomber. In July of 2002, a special anti-terrorism court in Pakistan found Ahmed Omar Sheikh and three accomplices guilty of the kidnapping and murder. Omar Sheikh, who organized the kidnapping, was sentenced to death, the other three to life imprisonment. They are appealing. Marianne Pearl was 6 months pregnant when her husband was killed. She was in Pakistan reporting for French public television and radio. The Pearls often traveled together on assignment. She's written a new book about the life and death of her husband called A Mighty Heart. Before we talk about your husband and your book, I just want to ask you for your reactions to some conclusions in a new book about your husband by the French writer Bernard-Henri Lévy. He says that your husband was killed because he was on the verge of exposing connections between Al-Qaeda and the Pakistani government. And he also said that your husband was on the verge of exposing connections between between Al-Qaeda, between Islamic extremists and nuclear weapons. He said that Pakistan's nuclear weapons are in the hands of Islamic extremists, and your husband was on the verge of discovering more information about that. Does this sound true to you?
This does sound true to a certain extent. That is to say that after 2 months after the World Trade Center attacks, all the journalists were investigating. I mean, the main journalists were investigating on the links between Pakistan intelligence agencies, the current elements or ex members, agents, and the Al-Qaeda network, and particularly concerning weapons of mass destruction. Pakistan has the nuclear weapon. Were they facilitating it to Al-Qaeda? That was the question Danny was investigating. Absolutely. To assert that Danny was on the verge of finding the actual relationship and the names, it is possible. I don't think that he was the only one. I think that, it was, it's a complex story, but in the end, like after 2 months of reporting, things do come together. And Danny was very good at putting things together and reaching some conclusion. I mean, even if people are trying to hide. So Bernard Lévy's guess remains a guess because we don't have facts. It's not for sure, but I also think that that's what, obviously that's what the people were doing in Pakistan. That's why the main newspapers sent the journalists in Pakistan at that time. That was the question for the world, of course.
Lévy also says that your husband's killer was a member of the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service, and that the Pakistani government may be sheltering more men who were involved in his murder. Any reaction to that?
I'm trying to remain very close to truth and objectivity and not speculate so much. We don't know to this day exactly who were the three people who came the last day at the compound where Danny was held and killed him. So they likely could be members of the ISI, probably more supported by the ISI than members of the ISI, I would say. That's something we haven't proved yet.
But it's something you think might be true?
It's something that might be true. It might be members of the ex-ISI, as I call them, which is the people who have been dismissed, who had just been dismissed by President Musharraf, who at the time, again, had been banning jihadi movements. So that these people had links with the ex-ISI, there is no doubt about that, that they had been protected. The same way Omar Sheikh, who was the mastermind kidnapper, had links with the ISI.
Do you think your husband was killed just as, like, to set an example to other journalists, or do you think he was killed because he was on the verge of revealing major information?
I do not know that answer, Terry. I don't know yet. It might be possible that he was killed just because he was Jewish, or just because they wanted to scare other journalists and keep them away from Pakistan because there was something to hide. It's possible that they wanted to kill him because he was American only.
To your knowledge, what was your husband investigating when he met with Omar Saeed Sheikh?
Do you mean at the time? Did I know what he was doing, or now?
What did you know then, and what do you know now?
Well, I knew what he was doing. I knew again, like, you know, everybody was trying to find out how much Pakistan had helped the hijackers of 9/11 hijackers in their plot to destroy the towers. So there was this story that had come up in the Boston Globe that I had read at the time, saying, oh, maybe the spiritual leader of Omar Saeed Sheikh is in Pakistan, is in Karachi, and he is still in his madrasa and giving classes to this young man, potential terrorist. So I knew that. I knew that we were trying to find the links, and we were trying to find the electronic links, also the email, tracing emails. I did not know so much about Jilani, who is the person that was allegedly the spiritual leader of Omar Sheikh. I didn't know that he had so much record on in America, for like his organization was in the terrorist list of the FBI for a long time, and then was removed just because there was no activity recorded. But so I didn't know exactly the nature of Jilani, but I did know the nature of Richard Reid, like the rest of the world, and I had like a remote idea of, I mean, I knew Danny was going to go in a madrasa, which was fine. Like, we had gone to those madrasas in a number of times. That's what you do when you report in Karachi or in Pakistan. I mean, you get too close to these people, otherwise you can't do your work. So I wasn't that particularly worried. The reason usually I would accompany him on those kind of travels, but that day first of all, I had an interview myself. I was doing, as I said before to you, that I was doing a documentary for French radio at the time, so I was recording an interview. And the second thing, we had been in the region for 3 months, and it had been very, very intense 3 months, of course, after the World Trade Center attacks, and I was really tired of hearing the same jihadi speeches again. So I decided not to go with him, but I was not particularly alarmed that day.
You knew one of the things that your husband was investigating was the possibility of a link between Richard Reid, the shoe bomber, and the radical Muslim cleric Sheikh Mubarak Ali Jilani, who was in Karachi.
Right.
So you knew that he was investigating that. Were there other things that you thought he was investigating as well, or that in retrospect you know now that he was investigating?
Yes, there was a number of things, but first let me know that the question he's trying to answer was Jilani more than just a spiritual leader? Mm-hmm. Because Richard Reid had missed the plane that he was supposed to take in Paris, that he wanted to blow, and he had sent an email in Karachi that had just been established, that the email had been sent in Karachi, and the answer had been provided from Karachi, saying, just take the next plane and blow it up, right? So so there was something very newsy there that was happening. Now, in the meantime, of course, then he was working on different stories. One of them, of course, was following up on what is the situation with the nuclear weapon program and any relationship with Al-Qaeda. That was like an ongoing story because no one had really proved anything. And that was, of course, the main topic for the rest of the world, right? But that's what he was doing all the time. So mainly those different, those two axes, the nuclear weapon program and the links between Pakistan and Al-Qaeda.
Before your husband decided to actually take the risk and meet with a disciple of Sheikh Jilani, he asked people for advice, and the advice he basically got was, it's okay as long as you meet him in a public place.
Right.
Was he confident, was your husband confident that if he met Jilani in a public place that he'd be safe? And was he confident that their meeting would really be in a public place?
was absolutely, Danny was absolutely confident that that meeting with someone who could be dangerous in a public place was a safe way to go, because that's what we do all the time. That's the only way you can actually approach those people. And because he had asked us questions to three different people, I am sure that he remained confident that the meeting would happen in that restaurant where they had their appointment.
And do you know if they actually first met in a public place and then he got abducted, or how the kidnapping actually happened?
As far as we know, yes, they did meet at that place, but I do not know how the kidnapping actually happened. I don't know if anybody pulled a gun or just pushed him in a car or just convinced him that he was just going a few meters away and to get in a car. I don't know yet that answer.
Now, you write in your book that you and your husband used to signal each other when you were alone, that you'd like to report together, and you usually accompanied each other. But when you couldn't, you'd signal each other so that, you know, you'd be able to relay to the other that, you know, that you were safe or that he was
right.
Safe. When did you realize, after not hearing from your husband, that chances were he wasn't safe?
Very quickly, because there was some kind of sensation that I had that made me feel uncomfortable. So I started calling him. We would usually call each other every 90 minutes. That was the standard time. But I started calling him before. Like, I just wanted some kind of reassurance. Something in me was uncomfortable. So very quickly I started calling, and the phone was off. I don't know if it was off or if it was out of range, but this voice kept coming back, and Danny would not answer. So very quickly, about his meeting was at I think 7, and at 8 o'clock I started calling, actually.
Now, some people say, well, you know, Daniel Pearl took a risk that he probably shouldn't have taken in meeting with this man, and you know, if he were more experienced, if he would have thought more about it, he wouldn't have taken that kind of risk. And you say in your book that he always played it really safe, and he refused to be a war correspondent. He didn't want to be in a war zone. When the Wall Street Journal, his newspaper, wanted to send him from Islamabad into Afghanistan after September 11th, he refused to go. And he even wrote a memo to the Wall Street Journal outlining several of the reasons why he didn't want to go. What were some of the reasons why he thought he was basically accusing the paper of not looking out enough for the safety of its reporters in war zones.
Yes, Terry, let me first tell you that if Danny had just made a mistake, I would admit it. You know, I would be honest enough to admit that day he just get carried away, because it's just a human thing to do. But it's not true. Danny was a really safe, safety conscious person, definitely more than I am. Everybody does that kind of thing when they work as foreign correspondent. You just report. That's what you do. Otherwise, you can't work, or you just stay in a hotel room and then you pretend you report. So that there was no options there. As far as the Wall Street Journal is concerned, Danny, to just, you know, let you know that I'm not inventing that, he wrote this safety memo because, contrary to what people say, he was an experienced journalist, and he had covered dangerous zones. And after one of them in Kosovo, he had written a safety memo to the Wall Street Journal saying, yes, you send us there, but you don't even remember that you're sending us to war, because that was his own experience. He had been in Kosovo, and when he talked to his boss back in New York, the person said, oh, I forgot where you are, right? So then he was really angry at that, and he wrote a memo that was for his safety, but for all foreign correspondents' safety. And it was a very detailed memo saying, we need that to be out of danger.
Yeah, one of the things he said in that memo was, several times I've told my editor or the news assistant that I'll be checking in daily and they should call if they don't hear from me. But when I went a few days without checking in, I never got a call.
Right, that's one of the examples. He was asking for check-ins, he was asking for equipment, he was asking for cash, just elements that would, and training, and safety training, and even, you know, he's even talking about kidnapping situation. So he's asking more training, because he's saying basically that the Wall Street Journal, in a way, positions itself as a newsy, but a newspaper that's not like a news It's a newspaper, but it's like more economic, and it doesn't go to war, it doesn't go on the front line. And it was, you know, obviously wrong. We were in the front line, and we were mandated there, so it was obviously wrong.
When your husband was missing, and you knew he was in serious trouble, you wanted to convince his kidnappers to release him. You were about 6 months pregnant at the time. The journalists of the world were trying to interview you. What were some of the things you thought about in deciding what your public role should be and how you should publicly present yourself, you know, in a way that could possibly help save your husband?
Right. The only thought I had in my head when we decided that I should try to make a public appearance on television was maybe Danny's watching me. Which means the way I wanted to present myself is communicate with him and say I'm here, like I'm strong, like I'm with you, we are together, and I wanted to convey that message to him that I was not destroyed or anything like that, that the baby was fine. So that was my main concern, and my only concern really. I also thought if he's watching me, then his captors also are watching me. To these people also, I am going to tell them, if you think you've taken everything away from me, it's wrong. You know, you're not achieving your aim, which is, you know, they were trying to terrify you. So I was not terrified. I was just like, you know, trying to have a language of common sense. And I thought, based on my experience of talking with these people, that was the best thing to do, as opposed to, you know, be crying on TV.
Did you think that it would be possible to get sympathy from the terrorists because you and your husband were expecting a baby?
I did not think I could expect sympathy from terrorists. The only thing I could hope was that they were publicity hungry, and they wanted, you know, a lot of attention, and then they'll release Danny because that was their plan in the first place. That's the only thing I could hope for. The people who have, you know, destroyed 3,000 lives in the World Trade Center, of people who had not done nothing to them and they were completely innocent, would not release Danny because I was pregnant. I knew that since day one.
You got a series of four photographs of your husband before he was executed. Would you just describe those photos?
When we received those photos, we were all waiting for signs. We had been without any kind of message for 3 days. I was surrounded by people that helped me read those photos. Those photos, the first one was Danny with a gun pointed on his head, and he had his head down. You could see, it's a very strange picture because you can see he's smiling, which is, of course, a message, the same message that I would have had on television, right, by being strong. The second photo is him with shackles on his hand, but he's also doing the finger, you know, giving the finger, you say,
mm-hmm.
I think,
yeah.
You know, and on two of those pictures. So in all of them, he managed to communicate his state of mind and his strength and everything, his love and his defiance. So he was at the same time, of course, scary to see him with a gun pointed at his head. But at the same time, it was very comforting because I knew he was exactly in the same state of mind than I was.
His execution was videotaped, and at the end, he's on tape saying, "My father is Jewish, my mother is Jewish, I am Jewish." Do you think he was told to say that?
I think he might have been told to say that, to say that he was Jewish. But what he wasn't told, because that wouldn't have been possible, was that his grandfather had a street named after him in a little village in Israel. And so that's an information that only his family could know, only I could know. And that's his way of saying, I am proud of who I am, and that's how I'm going to die.
Do you think a lot about the attitude with which he faced death, and do you, when you think about his attitude, do you find that comforting or upsetting?
His attitude is very comforting. I mean, it's not comforting. It may not be the right word, but I constantly come back to that moment when faced with first, and I mean, he couldn't avoid his death. There was nothing he could do. But faced by people who wanted to kill him for who he was, he decided to be proud, sorry, of who he was. That strength and that courage he had is something I always come back to in mind to go on with my life or to do what I have to do. And, you know, when I'm very too sad, I just always come back to that moment and gather strength from it.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Back with journalist Marianne Pearl. She's written a memoir about her late husband, Daniel Pearl, called A Mighty Heart. He was the Wall Street Journal's South Asia bureau chief and was investigating connections to Al-Qaeda in Pakistan. On the way to a planned meeting with a radical Islamic cleric, he was kidnapped and later beheaded by Islamic extremists. When we left off, we were talking about the videotape the extremists made of Pearl's execution. How did you find out that he was executed?
I found out because the video was out. For 2 weeks, we didn't know what had happened, and then suddenly the video was out, was released by the people who had edited it. So the FBI had a call and received the video, and all the investigative team went to Randall Bennett's house, was one of the investigators, and watched the video and authenticated it. So then they came back to the house and they told me.
That video ended up on the internet. One news organization, at least one news organization, played part of it. You were very upset that it was being circulated. You've never seen it yourself.
No, I haven't seen it, no.
Can you talk a little bit about your reaction to the circulation of the video?
The reason why they killed Danny the way they killed him, beheaded him, and taped this whole his murder was to the sole purpose was to show that video and terrify people. So it was a strategy. Of course, you know, they send out those tapes to news organizations and put it on the internet because that was their point, that was their goal. Now it was up to the news organization to decide what to do with these images. The fact that they had at least one news organization, which is CBS, decided to broadcast it was very sad. Not so much because. You know, I mean, it's because it's vulgar, but more because that's exactly what the terrorists wanted them to do. And that the fact that they didn't understand that for a country that had just been hit by terrorism so hard, that made me angry, very angry.
What about the vulgar aspects of it? What about the aspect that there are people in the country who saw your husband being beheaded on video?
You know, there people are. There is like a you know a dark side or animal side or in human beings that are attracted to you know those kind of images. It's like lower instincts, right? Basic instincts. You can appeal to that because that you know generates interest, generates money, generates viewing and ratings. It's a responsibility to broadcast those images, you know. And the only reason that I found on the internet, because there were people chatting about it, should they do it, should they not do it, the only reason for it was freedom of expression. It's completely wrong. That's not a freedom of expression. That's pure, you know, pure animal instinct, you know, the same way there are videos about people being murdered, I mean, all kinds of other murders or rapes or that kind of, that's how low it is. There's nothing there. There's nothing there in terms of, you know, the reason that was explained to me was it's newsworthy, and it wasn't newsworthy, you know. It was no news. Like, we knew what had happened to Danny. It was just, you know, it was just, voyeurism. I don't know the word in English. It's, you know, when you want to...
Voyeurism.
Voyeurism, exactly.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Marianne Pearl, and she's written a new book about the kidnapping and murder of her husband, the journalist Daniel Pearl. How has the kidnapping and murder of your husband affected your willingness to travel or the kind of journalism that you practice?
It made me more determined to do what we did together. One of my challenges, you know, what I did for me to survive was that I listed all the goals that the terrorists had. You know, I did the opposite of CBS, and I decided to deny them all those goals. So one of those goals was to instill fear in me, of traveling, of others, of, you know, make me lose my confidence. And I fought very hard so that they, you know, they wouldn't achieve that goal. So I'm still very much interested by, you know, the human race and our world. And Danny taught me so much about, you know, good journalism and objectivity and truth. I will definitely go on.
How old is your son now?
He's 16 months. He walks.
Good.
He talks.
Good. Well, you know, in a few years, you'll have to kind of figure out how much to tell him and how much to protect him from. Have you started to figure out already what the right equation is of what to reveal and what to keep from him for a while?
I haven't really figured out how I'm going to deal with this issue. It's something, of course, obviously, that keeps me very, you know, worried, and, you know, thinking also. I figured that the best thing I could do is, in the meantime, before the time comes to sit down with him and tell him that his father was murdered, first of all, write this book for him, so that he can know the truth. If everything that I've written, I make it true in my daily life, then Adam will be all right. I mean, it's going to be, of course, a difficult, like, he's going to have to bear his burden, and I'm bearing mine, but we'll be together, and hopefully he'll, what he retained mostly in his heart will be to be a kind of man his father would be proud of.
Are you living in France or the United States now?
In New York City, yeah, in the village.
How do you like it there?
I like it. Now, you know, I came here to write this book, so it was a very, you know, obviously a very difficult year for me, very lonely and cold and a difficult year. So New York was a good shelter for me because it's such a mix of everything. So I could, like, lose myself a little bit in New York City. But it was difficult, obviously. Now, it's better now. I have friends. I've, you know, created a little environment, so it's getting better and better.
Marianne Pearl, I really want to thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
Marianne Pearl's book about her late husband, Daniel Pearl, is called A Mighty Heart.